Hello and welcome to Ox Talk for Tuesday, the 30th of June 2026. My name is Guy and I've compiled the edition for this week. News items have been selected from local Oxford papers by Patricia Lee and Freya Torkinson. They have been recorded at home by Sean Kendall and Patricia Lee. The USBs have been copied and distributed by Michelle Lawful. Sunrise today is at 4:46 a.m. and sunset is at 9:28 p.m. On a personal note, usually when it's my turn to produce an edition of Ox Talk, I include events from history. Before I do that today, I'd like to remember Joyce Ellis, a long-time Ox Talk listener and member of the old OAB social group Oxvic, who died recently. Joyce regularly sent messages to Ox Talk telling us how much she enjoyed the history items. So, today's Wander Through History for June the 30th is dedicated to her. In 1377, the foundation stone for Ulm Minster in the free imperial city of Ulm in the Holy Roman Empire was laid. Construction lasted for over 500 years, finally being completed in 1890, when it became the tallest church in the world. In 1704, the first trial for piracy by the British Admiralty Court outside of Britain found Captain John Quelch and five of his crew guilty and sentenced them to hang the same day. Quelch had a very lucrative, albeit short, career as a pirate. It lasted just 1 year, but in that time he stole over £10,000 sterling, the equivalent of £1.9 million today. In 1737, British Commissioners of Longitude granted self-taught clockmaker John Harrison £500, the equivalent of about £140,000 today, after the successful trial of his first longitudinal clock. The longitude problem had long been an issue for mariners, and the development of longitudinal clocks by several inventors allowed them to find their exact position while at sea. 1860 saw the Oxford debate on evolution. Known as the Great Debate, this debate on Charles Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection was held at the Oxford University Museum, now the Oxford University Museum of Natural History, in front of a noisy crowd of around 500 people. It was dominated by arguments between Thomas Henry Huxley, a biologist from London who was arguing the case for natural selection, and the Bishop of Oxford, Samuel Wilberforce, who was arguing against. The debate was quite riotous, with both parties slinging insults at one another. In 1894, London's Tower Bridge was opened by Edward, Prince of Wales, and Alexandra, Princess of Wales. While it has become a recognisable London landmark, it has sometimes been confused with London Bridge, which lies about half a mile upstream. This in turn has led to a persistent urban legend about an American buying the wrong bridge. In 1908, a giant fireball, most likely caused by the airburst of a large meteoroid or comet, flattened 80 million trees near the stony Tunguska River in Yeniseysk Governorate, Russia, in the largest impact event in recorded history. In 2022, New York was named the world's wealthiest city, home to 345,600 millionaires and 59 billionaires, with Tokyo and San Francisco making up the top three. Births on this day. In 1685, John Gay, English poet and dramatist famous for the Beggar's Opera, was born in Barnstaple, Devon. In 1942, Robert Ballard, American explorer who discovered the wreck of the Titanic in 1985, was born in Wichita, Texas. In 1959, Vincent D'Onofrio, American actor, was born in Brooklyn, New York City. D'Onofrio is probably most famous for his roles in the films Full Metal Jacket, Men in Black, and Jurassic World, as well as starring in the TV series Law & Order Criminal Intent and as Kingpin in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. In 1962, Julianne Regan, English-Irish rocker with the group All About Eve, was born in Coventry. In 1966, Mike Tyson, American boxer, was born in Brooklyn, New York. He became the youngest ever heavyweight boxing champion in 1986 at the age of 20 years, 4 months and 22 days. In 1972, James Martin, English celebrity chef, probably best known as a host of Saturday Kitchen, was born in Malton in the North Riding of Yorkshire. And deaths on this day. In 1520, Moctezuma II, an Aztec emperor, was killed aged about 66. Some Spanish reports say that he was killed by a stone thrown by one of his own people during a riot, while indigenous reports say he was either strangled or shot by Spanish conquistadors. In 1966, Marjorie Louise Allingham, English novelist from the golden age of detective fiction, died aged 62 at Severals Hospital in Colchester. Allingham is considered one of four queens of crime, alongside Agatha Christie, Dorothy L. Sayers, and Ngaio Marsh. She is best remembered for her hero, the gentleman sleuth Albert Campion, who first appeared in the novel The Crime at Black Dudley in 1929. Campion was portrayed on TV by Doctor Who actor Peter Davison. In 1973, Nancy Mitford, English author of Love in a Cold Climate and eldest of the infamous Mitford sisters, died of cancer aged 68 at a home in the Rue de Troyes in Versailles. In 1971, Georgi Dobrovolsky, Viktor Patsayev and Vladislav Volkov, Soviet cosmonauts, died aboard the Soyuz 11 spacecraft. The crew capsule depressurized during preparations for re-entry, killing all on board. The three crew members are the only humans to have died in space. And in 1997, Professor Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, fictional character of the Harry Potter novels and headmaster of Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, died, aged 115. And now, on to the news for this week. We hope you enjoy our choice of articles.
There are fresh fears fire stations could close as a site is revealed for a proposed new fire and rescue hub north of the city. Land has been identified for a new fire station in a new innovation district near Pertrie Roundabout. But there are concerns the proposal will reignite plans by Oxfordshire County Council to close a number of existing fire stations, a move described by critics as madness. Last year, Oxfordshire County Council shared plans to cut fire services, including the closure of on-call stations. It is feared services could be lost at Rooley Road in Oxford and in Kidlington. The proposals received a huge backlash, with protests by firefighters and threats of strike action. The plans were paused in April, in part due to uncertainty around developer negotiations over the building of a replacement fire station in the north of the city. Now, proposals for a 900 million science park on Freeze Farm near Pertrie Roundabout, with a data centre, hotel, college and housing, have included 900 square metres for a fire station. The plan submitted to Charwell District Council said, following preliminary discussions with the County Council, the application site was identified as potentially suitable for future fire station facilities, given its excellent connectivity to the highway network. It emphasises there are currently no proposals for the facility, and the land could provide flexibility in support of the future provision of a fire station in the area. County Council leader Liz Brighouse said when plans were pulled back previously, everybody breathed a sigh of relief and thought it had gone away. But of course it hadn't. County Council Green Leader and Charwell Councillor Ian Middleton called the situation concerning. He described a sub-optimal configuration for emergency traffic, with busy roundabouts at access points to the city and villages, along with potential for huge congestion on event days if new Oxford United Stadium plans are approved. Acting Brigade Secretary Jonathan Shuker for Oxfordshire Fire Brigade Union said assurances that the site is a proposal for a potential site, rather than guaranteed to go ahead, had limited concerns for the union. An Oxfordshire Fire and Rescue Service spokesman said, "The work undertaken as part of the Improving Our Fire and Rescue Service consultation demonstrated that there are some benefits to having a fire station positioned towards the north of Oxford. While no decisions have been made about adopting such proposals, we are continuing to explore opportunities to locate a fire station." They added, "The Freeze Farm development is one of a potential number of options being considered. Nothing has been decided about whether a North Oxford fire station would ever go ahead, nor has any decision been made on the future of Rooley Road Fire Station."
A flag-raising ceremony has paid tribute to the dedication and sacrifice of armed forces personnel in Oxfordshire. The event was held recently at County Hall in Oxford as part of this year's Armed Forces Day celebrations. Military guests in attendance included Wing Commander Alice Tierney from RAF Benson, alongside dignitaries such as the Lord Lieutenant of Oxfordshire, Margery Glasgow, the High Sheriff of Oxfordshire, Javed Malik, and Councillor Roz Smith, Vice Chair of Oxfordshire County Council. Councillor Smith said, "Oxfordshire's strong military ties make this ceremony resonate with many residents in our county. Similar events in towns and cities across the country will be taking place today and throughout the United Kingdom this week. We pay respect to the achievements and sacrifices of those who serve or have served in His Majesty's Armed Forces." She also highlighted the county's substantial military community. Councillor Smith said, "Oxfordshire has a large military presence with more than 25,000 military personnel and an estimated 3,500 families living and working in the county. Two-thirds of these are members of the RAF. She emphasised ongoing support through the Armed Forces Covenant and the county's six military champions who work closely with personnel and their families. Councillor Smith said, "On behalf of Oxfordshire County Council, I'd like to express our admiration and gratitude to all military personnel and families here in Oxfordshire and to those currently serving abroad." The ceremony featured a military parade by personnel from RAF Bryce Norton.
Oxfordshire County Council has published a list of 11 quiet lane requests where the majority of cars will soon be banned. Roads include Bagley Wood Road, often used as a cut-through from the Oxford Road from Abingdon to Kennington, requested by Kennington Parish Council. Sunningwell Road and, or Green Lane, was requested to become a quiet lane by Sunningwell Parish Council. In nearby Radley, Sugworth Lane, Kennington Road to Oxford Road, is also set to be a quiet lane, as requested by the village's parish council. Other roads include Lower Road and Station Road in Blackthorn, east of Bicester, requested by its parish, and the road through Bainton, the B4100 to Stratton Audley Road at Stoke Lyne and Caversfield. The road from Hanwell to Great Bourton near Banbury, Hanwell Lane, has also been requested by Liberal Democrat councillor Chris Brandt. Evenlode Lane in Fawler, West Oxfordshire, roads connecting Towersey to the B445 and the A4129 in South Oxfordshire, Battle Road in Goring, and Kingston Hill and Aston Rowant take the list of requests to 11, all submitted by the respective parishes. Going forward, Oxfordshire County Council said each application will now be assessed using a standard method to ensure decisions are transparent, consistent, and evidence-led. This is part of a 7-stage implementation process, which includes local engagement and a cabinet member decision before a pilot is trialled, followed by a statutory consultation to monitor the impact and help in final decision making, it said. Shepherd's Pits Lane in Stanton St John is expected to be the first pilot later this summer, following feedback from the public. Gates and bollards will be used to block general traffic from accessing the roads, and Oxfordshire County Council says its pilot is an enhancement to Department for Transport policy, going beyond traditional signage-based lanes to achieve the safest outcomes. Gareth Epps, Cabinet Member for Traffic on Oxfordshire County Council, said, "Quiet lanes will make roads safer and encourage sustainable travel. Before any sites are trialled, we will expect to see dialogue with local residents and other stakeholders, including businesses such as farms, to understand potential impacts and help to decide whether to continue developing an individual quiet lane," he added. "If a quiet lane does go ahead as a trial, changes can be made and there will be a public consultation to gather feedback. As part of the pilot programme, we would not consider a quiet lane on a road where there is a bus route." He said all pilot sites will be consulted on and no decisions on whether to make them permanent will be made until a pilot is evaluated.
Oxfordshire's new described Pothole Queen has made a guarantee to the county amid its road repairs crisis and ongoing backlog. Liz Leffman was leader of the Oxfordshire County Council for 5 years and stepped down from the role last month, taking on the newly created position of Cabinet Member for Highways Construction and Repair. The job had been dubbed Pothole Tsar, but she said she prefers the title Pothole Queen. This restructuring split up the transport boss role previously held by Andrew Gant in a move Ms. Leffman hopes will ensure greater efficiency to tackle the highway situation, which has seen road users warning of craters and danger, including Transport Secretary Heidi Alexander, after her Mini Cooper was damaged. There remains a 4,000 pothole backlog in the county, which Ms. Leffman hopes to see filled by the end of this month. She also says the council will be resurfacing a lot of roads over the summer, which should mean we won't have as many potholes to worry about this winter. Ms. Leffman said, "While she cannot guarantee the weather and its impact on the roads, I hope that we can guarantee that we will manage that more efficiently with longer, more lasting and more resistant to pothole fillings." She said, "Over time, we will get on top of this problem." Oxford United have confirmed that the season ticket sales records have been broken ahead of the 2026-27 League One season. The previous season ticket sales record for the third tier was approximately 5,000, a number which has been smashed already this summer since going on general sale. 6,500 tickets have already been sold, which is an impressive statement of backing from supporters after last season's relegation from the Championship. The club's head of revenue, Lee Barton, said, "Reaching 6,500 season ticket sales at this stage is a fantastic achievement and a clear demonstration of the passion and loyalty of our supporters. Breaking our previous League One record by such a margin is something everyone connected with Oxford United can be proud of. The support we receive from our fans makes a real difference, and we'd like to thank each of them for backing us in such great numbers as we head into the 2026-27 season." Season tickets for the upcoming season are capped at 7,000, with the final 500 currently on general sale. Oxford United are currently out of the race for Colchester United forward Kyrys Lisby, as Reading have a bid accepted. Oxford sacked their head coach Matt Bloomfield on Saturday, almost 2 months after the end of their Championship campaign, with the club currently searching for a new name to guide them into League One. The U's had expressed interest in Lisby, having met with the 22-year-old previously, but have since reduced their interest. The club has made no recent contact whilst three League One rivals have had bids accepted. According to the Reading Chronicle, Reading, Huddersfield Town and Sheffield Wednesday have all had bids accepted, with Sky Sports Now reporting that Lisby is undergoing a medical with the Royals. The location of the Berkshire club is understood to have been a factor in choosing Reading as his next destination. Interest from Oxford is now considered over, especially after the departures of Bloomfield and head of recruitment Scott Mitchell to Leyton Orient earlier this month. The Colchester man had his breakout season last term after moving to Essex from Brentford in 2025, scoring 11 goals and managing 6 assists in 45 League Two appearances. He has been the subject of plenty of interest in League One this summer, with Peterborough United also previously interested but deciding against meeting Lisby's wage demands. United are yet to make their first signing of the summer transfer window, which officially opened last week. The club has undergone significant changes higher up in the food chain after Mitchell's departure and the arrival of new chairman Dusan Bogdanovic, who replaced Grant Ferguson, the former chair moving to a role on the board. Head coach Bloomfield was dismissed at the weekend, meaning the club's next priority is finding a new boss, with the players reporting back for the pre-season on Wednesday, June the 24th. Ex-Arsenal midfielder Aaron Ramsey is the favourite to take over as head coach at Oxford United and understands the club is impressed by the young coach. The U's parted ways with head coach Matt Bloomfield on Saturday, almost 2 months after suffering relegation to League One late in the Championship season. Bloomfield took over in January after Gary Rowett was sacked 2 days before Christmas and oversaw an upturn in form, but was unable to find enough points to guide Oxford to safety. The club's search for a new head coach is underway, with former Wales international Ramsey emerging as the bookmaker's favourite to lead the Yellows into the 2026-27 season. There is longer-standing interest in Ramsey, with the 35-year-old impressing the club's higher-ups in an earlier meeting between the two parties. After retiring from professional football in April of this year, it is understood that the three-time FA Cup winner is on the lookout for his first managerial role. Ramsey has taken charge of a club briefly, receiving the reins at Cardiff City for a span of 3 games in 2025, after Omar Reza was dismissed by the Welsh outfit, seeing the Bluebirds relegated at the end of the 2024-25 season. He has also shadowed Wales's boss Craig Bellamy and is training for his UEFA Pro licence. A carefully born Welshman began his career at Cardiff before moving to Arsenal as a 17-year-old. He spent 11 years with the Gunners, becoming a club hero, winning 3 FA Cups and 2 Community Shields. A move to Italian giants Juventus in 2019 saw him become a league title winner in his first season before spells at Rangers, OGC Nice, Cardiff and Mexican club UNAM closed out his impressive career. If Ramsey were to be appointed Oxford boss, it would follow the trend of young, big-name managers taking over in League One, along with former teammate Jack Wilshere at Luton Town and ex-Manchester United man Tom Cleverley at Plymouth Argyle. Ramsey's lack of head coach experience means it would come with its risks. However, it would be a statement of intent and a bold move from head of football operations Ed Waldron, new chairman Dusan Bogdanovic, and owner Eric Tohier. United are currently looking for their 5th boss in 3 years, with the aim of staying in the second tier, meaning the club moved to a more pragmatic style of football under Rowett. They then acted again when the former Yellows head coach began last season poorly, bringing in Bloomfield in an attempt to replicate the impact that his predecessor had in the previous campaign.
Raise the Colours activists have agreed to stop raising English flags after a court battle. Ryan Bridge, Ben Cullen and Trudy Wells, as well as Kevin Good, who did not attend court, have said they will no longer put flags up on lampposts in Oxfordshire. Oxfordshire County Council brought legal action against the group at the High Court, winning a ruling to stop people raising flags near highways, saying it involved safety risks, as well as trespass and obstruction. The widespread flying of Union and St George's Cross flags following an online campaign called Operation Raise the Colours, has become contentious, and several local authorities have removed them from public infrastructure. While some politicians criticise the removals, others claim the increased number being flown was a result of xenophobia or racism. The county council said flags had been placed on or near public roads without permission for months, despite a formal legal notice in March and pre-action legal letters sent to individuals last month. Robin Green for the council told the High Court that Mr. Bridge, Mr. Cullen, Mr. Good and Ms. Wells had been involved. After a short hearing where the group represented themselves and spoke to Mr. Good by phone, they agreed not to put up more flags, not to encourage others to do so, and not to obstruct any council worker or contractor taking them down. Mr. Justice Dexter Diss set another hearing for July the 9th, to be attended by anyone wishing to oppose a court order stopping anyone else from putting up flags or obstructing staff. Mr. Green for the council said, "It is the council's case that no authorisation has been given to the named defendants, or indeed anyone else, to attach flags to lampposts, lighting columns or any other highway structure. So where that has been done, we say it is an offence." He said the council had also wished to pursue an injunction against the named group, but would be happy for them to make a formal undertaking to the court. Agreeing, Mr. Bridge said he had put up flags in Oxfordshire for about 6 hours in my life. "We did not want to cause any distress to anybody, which has been stated," he said. "I feel it's a sad day for the flag of our country and what it represents." Ms. Wells, who told the court that she had never put up any flags, but was said to have encouraged others online, added, "I'm not going to have anything to do with the flags anymore. It's not worth it." Council leader Tim Bearder said last week, "We proudly fly the Union flag and St. George's flag at County Hall, and we fully support the right of residents to display flags on their own private property. However, there's an important distinction between lawful expression and activity that puts people at risk or intimidates residents in their own communities."
The West End smash hits New Theatre Oxford this July. Stepping into John Cleese's long and weighty shoes is no mean feat, but it's one that Danny Bain jumped at with alacrity in West End smash Pulte Towers, the play. "It was daunting and exciting to be offered the part," Danny agrees, "because reality is that Basil Fawlty is a character that the public knows so well and are very protective of. They have expectations of who they expect to see on stage, plus everyone knows John Cleese. But the audience lets you know if it isn't working, and it's going to go really well." Coming to the New Theatre Oxford from July the 14th to the 18th, all hell looks set to break loose in this loving adaptation of the hysterical and infamous 70s comedy Fawlty Towers, voted the greatest British TV programme of all time in 2000, which splices together three of the most popular original episodes, The Hotel Inspector, The Germans and Communication Problems. The script is still as close to the original as it possibly can be. It's just been altered to link the three episodes together, and John Cleese came in at the end of rehearsals to make sure it was perfect. "And if John Cleese is happy, then it's good enough for me," Danny laughs. Still based on a guest house in Torquay where the Monty Python team once stayed, the shenanigans that the hotel team get up to behind the scenes, their inhospitable demeanours, and Basil and Sybil's temptatious relationship will have you weeping in the aisles. So does Mia Austin, who plays Sybil, believe the couple really hate each other? I think their relationship stems from exasperation rather than hatred. They must have loved each other once to have got married, but there is certainly an element of mutual loathing, she concurs. Basil and Sybil are a couple everyone can relate to. which means that it's so much fun to play Sybil, especially as Basil spends most of his time trying to hide from her. So yes, she's been my favourite character to play. I adore her because she wears the trousers. Brunella Scales, who played the original Sybil, said it best though. She said, "Everyone thinks Sybil is a dragon, but I call her a heroine. I think Sybil is one of the first feminists in comedy, but she is so self-possessed. She is a queen. So what do Danny and Mia think is Fawlty Towers' enduring appeal then?" There were only 12 episodes of Fawlty Towers, as if John Cleese knew it was perfect as it was and didn't want to overdo it. But Fawlty Towers is really a farce, and on stage that works really well, with people running around in and out of doors. And the set is like a big doll's house, so you can watch people doing things simultaneously in different rooms, with the action taking place all over the hotel, from the bedrooms and dining rooms to the reception. "It's really cleverly done," Mia explains. Having completed 800 performances already, I wonder how the pair keep it fresh. Oh, we still laugh all the time because it's such a fast-paced comedy, and the cast get on so well. So there are still lots of japes, she says. "But it also means that my children can't remember me without a moustache," Danny says. "And mine tell me off at home when I laugh like Sybil," Mia adds. "But I think when you have played a character for this long, it becomes part of you, and there's a real magic to that." So does this mean that the 3 episodes covered, there is a scope for further 9 to be aired in the future? Could Fawlty Towers, the play, too, be a reality? "I'm merely a hired hand, but I think there have been discussions," Danny says. But touring allows so many new audiences to see Fawlty Towers, the play. It is expensive to go and see it in the West End, so our audiences are delighted when we are bringing the show to them, Mia says. "Best gig so far, Torquay," they say in unison. "It was like a rock concert. John Cleese came along and people were buzzing for months." The joy of being able to watch Fawlty Towers, the play, on stage with the full approval of John Cleese himself seems too good an opportunity to miss then.
When I look back at my school days, I can't honestly say I remember much of it with fondness. Although I was academically bright enough to do well in lessons, I was relieved when the bell rang, signalling the end of the day. Through hours of stuffing my head full of facts, I kept myself going by thinking about what I would do as soon as I arrived home. Some of my friends enjoyed school, but one lesson filled most of us with dread. PE, or physical education, to give it the correct name. Quite what was educational about it is beyond me, given that I learned very little other than how to survive unscathed. I still do not fully understand the rules of hockey or netball, despite having been forced to play both for years. I was an active child, so it wasn't as if I was incapable. It was just the way PE was structured in most comprehensive schools during the 1970s and 80s, and the limited range of activities, which made it a test of endurance for many. Every lesson would be organised with military precision akin to an army training camp, and woe betide anyone who dared try to get out of PE on medical grounds. They would undergo an SAS-style interrogation. The activity that struck terror into most hearts was cross-country running. I'm told youngsters still do cross-country of sorts, but I can guarantee it isn't anything like the kind we were subjected to. Running was one of my fortes, but the conditions made cross-country into an expedition even Bear Grylls would struggle with. We would do cross-country whatever the weather, and we didn't wear any special kit either. Just our usual T-shirts and shorts, largely unsuitable for the route. We would run for miles across water meadows, through woods and uneven fields. Basically, places you'd avoid unless you were prepared to suffer a twisted ankle. And even if you sustained a sprain and tried to use it like a blighty wound to escape cross-country torture, you would be told to walk or limp the rest of the way. And to prevent the tardy from running at tortoise-like speed, cross-country always took place at the end of the day, So you'd be wasting your own time if you dallied, and risk missing the school bus. Our route cut through the centre of the water meadows, inhabited by a fearsome-looking herd of Highland cows. It also veered unbelievably close to the sewage works. If dodging cows through boggy terrain wasn't torture enough, the route forced us to jump over a sewer outflow, a considerable leap for a 10-year-old. As a relatively small child, I'm surprised I never fell in, but I think I was propelled by sheer willpower. On every run, some poor soul would fail to make it entirely across, losing their footing on the slippery bank. Those that succumbed to the sewer then had to do the rest of the race soaking wet and whiffing high. Needless to say, even those that evaded the sewer returned with chattering teeth, freezing cold, wet and plastered in mud. It wasn't like the non-cross-country PE lessons were great either. If the PE teachers didn't want to get cold, we would do circuit training in the school gym, which included wielding aloft a medicine ball, despite it weighing a ton. The circuit included balancing on beams, vaulting over wooden obstacles, and climbing a rope to the top of the gym, more than 20 feet up. In between, we would be prevented from catching our breath by commands to do umpteen star jumps and squats. The only team sports open for girls in those days were netball or hockey. Football and rugby were strictly for the boys. I loathed netball because I was small and was usually placed in the highly unsuitable position of goal defence. Even with my arms stretched fully above me, I could not prevent opponents with Amazonian proportions, always in the goal shooter position, from simply plopping the ball in the net directly over my head. Hockey was equally onerous, with at least one child ending the session with bruised shins. We had no protective equipment in those days. My good friend, who excelled at hockey, even managed to get her front tooth knocked out by an overzealous opponent wielding her hockey stick too high. It wasn't until we were older that PE lessons became tolerable, with options to play badminton or tennis instead. We were even allowed to join the boys for basketball, if we were lucky.
Oxford Speedway has announced a major change aimed at improving the match night experience for fans at Cowley. The club confirmed the update in a statement from promoter Jamie Courtney, who reflected on the venue's transformation in recent years before revealing the move. Mr. Courtney said the stadium had become a shell of its former self just over 5 years ago, describing it as derelict, crumbling, and slowly being reclaimed by weeds. He added that the Bet Goodwin Stadium is now a vibrant, modern stadium full of life, where the greatest show on shale once again belongs to Oxford. The promoter also pointed to challenges earlier this year, including the loss of greyhound racing, admitting it served as a reminder that nothing should ever be taken for granted. Mr. Courtney said investment from Mike Austin and Spencer Timo had helped put the club on a firmer footing, but stressed the ongoing demands behind the scenes. He said, "The reality of running a speedway club is long days, late nights, and a huge personal and financial commitment. After listening to supporters, the club has now confirmed the key change." Mr. Courtney said, "Starting this Wednesday, we're introducing a match night box office at the stadium, where supporters will be able to purchase tickets by cash or card." He added, "Many of you told us that the lack of an on-night payment option has been a barrier, and we want to remove that barrier completely." The club said further details on how the system will operate will be shared ahead of Wednesday's meeting. Mr. Courtney also thanked fans for the continued backing, saying, "You, the fans, are the heartbeat of this club." He urged supporters to continue turning out as the season intensifies, with the Cheetahs chasing the playoffs and the Chargers defending their National League title. "Wednesday nights are made for Speedway," he added.
More disruption is expected in Oxfordshire, after heat warnings have been extended as a record-breaking June heat wave continues. Scorching temperatures have caused disruption to schools, workers, businesses and more this week, with no sign of cooling off until the weekend. The Met Office extended a red warning of danger to life, even for people not usually vulnerable to the heat, due to exceptional high temperatures and humidity, to 9 p.m. today, June the 26th. More than 110 schools fully or partially closed on Wednesday, rising to around 140 yesterday, with some already announced and more expected to follow as the heat wave continues today. The head of one school, Sharon Nichols of the Warrener School in Banbury, described the unbearable conditions in the classroom in a letter sent out to parents, announcing the site's continued full closure today. Miss Nichols said, "This has not been an easy decision, but in order to keep our students and staff safe in the current extreme heat conditions, the school site will continue to be closed to students on Friday. We have just carried out a health and safety temperature check across site, and some of our classrooms at 10 a.m. were over 35 degrees Celsius. This decision has been taken very much in the interests of student and staff well-being and safety. It comes as the University of Oxford revealed that the Radcliffe Meteorological Station, which has the longest continuous single-site weather record beginning in 1772, on Tuesday recorded a provisional temperature matching the June record set in the 1976 heatwave, a scorching 34.3 degrees centigrade. Impacts from the heat have been recorded across the county, including in Grove, where a pavement appeared to be melting. Councillors Jane Hannah and Jenny Hannaby, Liberal Democrat County Councillors, said children had been playing with pieces of the broken asphalt. An update from the County Council's Highways team said the asphalt, which had broken away, had been cleared up by Persimmon Housing Developer, who will carry out remediation works when temperatures cool. To help locals, and especially families with children, to beat the heat, Oxford City Council announced the city's splash parks in Cutteslowe and Hinksey Park would remain open later, operating from 10:30 a.m. until 8 p.m. each day. Multiple water safety warnings have been issued by the authorities, including councils, Oxfordshire Fire and Rescue, and Thames Valley Police, as people trying to cool off in the hot weather create the risk of safety incidents. It comes as 15 people have already lost their lives in the water-related incidents in the UK this year, including a 14-year-old boy in Oxford who was swimming during a heatwave in May. A spokesperson for the fire service said, "Hot weather can make open water look like an easy way to cool off. It may look calm, but the risks are real, especially the sudden effects of cold water. With a red heat alert in place, we're asking everyone to take extra care near rivers, lakes and canals."
Strictly Come Dancing star Johannes Radebe will come to Oxford with his tour of a brand new show. From ballroom classics to South African rhythms and pop anthems, the 39-year-old professional dancer will take to the stage next year for his brand new show titled Johannes Radebe, Finally Home. Radebe, who made his West End debut starring as Lola in the Heat musical Kinky Boots, was announced as one of the new co-hosts for Strictly Come Dancing last month. He said, "People have been asking if I won't be dancing anymore. Darling, I'm just getting started. Bringing this tour, Finally Home, across the UK and Ireland is my way of saying thank you to everyone who has supported my journey. So come ready for joy, fun and celebration, because we're bringing the biggest party in your town and I cannot wait to dance with you all." Radebe will tour the UK and Ireland next year from April the 1st to June the 13th, with a gala performance scheduled at the London Palladium on May the 9th. Kicking off in High Wycombe, he will head up and down the UK and Ireland, including dates in Oxford, Blackpool, Manchester and Glasgow, with dates in Belfast, Dublin and Swansea. The professional dancer will end the tour with two nights in Plymouth before wrapping up in Cardiff. The South African dancer performed around the world before he was headhunted by BBC Strictly Come Dancing. In 2021, he came runner-up with the Great British Bake Off star John Waite, with the two becoming the first all-male partnership to reach the final. Alongside Strictly, he has toured the UK with solo shows starting in 2022 with Freedom, followed by Freedom Unleashed in 2023 and House of JoJo in 2024. In the autumn, he will front Strictly Come Dancing alongside broadcaster Emma Willis and comedian Geoff Widdicombe. The trio will preside over the ballroom, replacing Tess Daly and Claudia Winkleman, who announced they were leaving the show late last year.
A 2012 Olympic-style regeneration initiative will be launched in Oxford to help transform its shared region with Cambridge into Britain's answer to Silicon Valley, Rachel Reeves will reveal. The Chancellor is expected to announce plans for a Greater Oxford Development Corporation in the coming week, the Treasury said. A similar development corporation for Cambridge was launched earlier this year. The authorities will help the two university cities and their surrounding regions build new infrastructure as the government aims to boost economic growth across the area. Ms. Reeves is expected to announce the Greater Oxford Development Corporation ahead of giving this year's Mace Lecture, a speech which will reportedly focus on the government's growth mission. The so-called Oxford-Cambridge Corridor is one of the only UK regions outside of London which is a net contributor to Britain's economy. Ministers hope they can spark further economic growth by supporting the technology, manufacturing and research sectors in the area between the two university cities. New house building and transport links between Oxford, Cambridge and other major settlements like Milton Keynes and Bedford are among the measures which are being slowly rolled out to achieve this. The Chancellor will back the two development corporations by doubling the funding available to buy land and build infrastructure from £400 million up to £800 million. A Treasury spokesman said, "Our plans for the Oxford-Cambridge corridor are ambitious. The prize on offer is to have the Silicon Valley of Europe here in Britain, bringing more jobs and more vibrant places to live. We have the right economic plan, and this week the Chancellor will set out how the regions are crucial to the next decade of growth." Development corporations have previously been used to spearhead major regeneration projects in Britain, including the Olympic Park in Stratford, East London. They have, however, been criticised as undemocratic and unaccountable, as they take planning powers away from local councils. Ms. Reeves announced a £500 million investment package into the scheme in October last year, including £120 million for the Kylie Branch line to be reopened in Oxfordshire. The Chancellor says the corridor could add £78 billion to the UK's economy by 2035 and has committed to funding for the East-West Rail Link, joining the cities which host the country's two top universities and the towns such as Bedford and Milton Keynes, which sit between them.
Oxford has officially welcomed its first Hindu temple. More than 300 people gathered for the opening ceremony at Cork Lace Farm, Marsh Lane, Marston, where Oxford Hindu Temple and Community Centre now stands after an 18-year campaign to establish a dedicated place of worship. The King sent a message of support, calling the temple a vibrant new hub for Hindu culture and community life. King Charles III said, "Community centres like this one are instrumental to social cohesion, offering a place of welcome for people of all faiths and none." The Lord Lieutenant of Oxfordshire, Marjorie Glasgow, officially opened the centre, joined by dignitaries including the High Sheriff of Oxfordshire, Javed Malik, Oxfordshire East MP, Annalise Dodds, and Oxford City Council leader, Suzanne Brown. The ceremony began with a Kalash Yatra parade outside the temple, accompanied by dhol drummers, followed by religious songs and cultural dance performances. Mrs. Glasgow praised the community's efforts, having raised more than £400,000 to transform the derelict building into a place of worship and activity. He said, "This is a true transformation, not just of bricks and mortar, but of purpose and meaning. This is a powerful demonstration of what can be achieved through patience, purpose, and determination. It's a real inspiration to other communities working towards their own dreams. It shows what is possible when people refuse to give up, even when the road ahead is long." Ms. Dodds described the new temple as a symbol of Oxfordshire's inclusivity. He said, "This is a wonderful symbol of our city, because now we have this incredible, beautiful temple for our Hindu population." Mr. Malik highlighted Oxfordshire's welcome spirit and said the temple would enrich the county's cultural, spiritual and civic life for generations to come. Mark Bagwandin, the temple secretary and trustee, said the new centre holds deep significance for the Hindu community. Mr. Bagwandin said the temple will help carry the faith, culture and traditions of Hindus in Oxfordshire into future generations. "It will also help us to share the culture with the wider community. This is a temple not just for Hindus, but for everyone in the county." The idea began 18 years ago, with a small group holding havans in their homes. As numbers grew, gatherings moved to community halls, most recently the Rose Hill Community Centre. Just over 3 years ago, the group successfully bid for the disused Court Place farm site from Oxfordshire City Council. Most of the £400,000 raised to renovate the site came from within the Hindu community. In addition to worship, the temple will offer workshops in well-being, yoga, music, dance and language, and aims to serve the broader community.
Parking wardens may soon be able to give out fines to drivers who park on the pavement, under plans that look increasingly likely to go ahead. Pavement parking will be debated by councillors and Oxfordshire County Council next week, after a motion was put forward by Bethia Thomas. The council leader for the Vale of Whitehorse district has put forward plans to the county to ban this method of parking. And pavement parking doesn't just mean leaving an entire car on the path. It can include leaving two wheels on the edge of the curb too. Miss Thomas will say to the council that it causes significant danger, particularly to disabled people or those with mobility issues. Meanwhile, County Council Cabinet Member for Transport, Gareth Epps, like his predecessor Andrew Gant, has also backed a ban on pavement parking. He told this newspaper, the Oxford Mail, that it wouldn't be a countrywide blanket ban but would be introduced on a case-by-case basis for each pavement. Miss Thomas said the call for the civil enforcement officers to be given powers to enforce the policy is cost neutral to the council. If her motion is successful next Tuesday, council leader Tim Bearder will write to the local transport minister in Westminster asking for further resources to implement the ban. Mr. Epps said, "I am pleased that the government has given local government powers relating to pavement parking, and there have been calls for this for many years. I look forward to the debate next Tuesday." In January, the Department for Transport said councils would be given new and improved legal control to make it easier to restrict pavement parking across wider areas. This is instead of relying on the previous approach, where action is often limited to individual streets and requires lengthy, complex processes, the government said. Local Transport Minister Lillian Greenwood explained that clear pavements are essential for people to move around safely and independently, whether that's a parent with a pushchair, someone using a wheelchair, or a blind or partially sighted person. A survey of 1,709 UK drivers commissioned by the RAC last year suggested 83% want new rules on pavement parking. RAC Senior Policy Officer Rod Dennis said pavement parking is a serious problem in some communities that needs tackling. He added, no pavement user should be forced into walking or wheeling into the road because of someone parking inconsiderately. A clear majority of drivers agree and want to see an end to needless pavement parking that causes accessibility problems. But when it comes to the solution, the jury is out.
About a third of pupils at a top private school in Oxford are now attending top universities. Magdalen College School in East Oxford has revealed that a third of last year's leavers are now studying at universities ranked amongst the world's top 10, according to new release data. 53 out of 156 pupils at the school in Cowley Place from the 2025 cohort took up places at institutions featuring in the top 10 of the QS World University Rankings of 2027. In second place, Imperial College London with 11 MCS pupils. In fourth place, University of Oxford with 8 of the 53. In fifth place, Harvard University with 1. In sixth place, University of Cambridge with 17. And in eighth place, University College London with 16. This success looks set to continue, with pupils in the 2026 cohort having already secured offers from Oxford and Cambridge, alongside a range of leading overseas universities, including Ivy League institutions in the United States. The QS rankings provide an independent assessment of universities worldwide and are widely regarded as one of the leading measures of higher education excellence. A place in the top 10 is highly sought after, reflecting outstanding performance across a range of measures, including research and discovery, employability and outcomes, international engagement, and sustainability. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, topped the latest rankings. Four of the world's top 10 universities are based in the UK, with the remainder located in the United States, Switzerland, and Singapore. Peter McDonald, Director of Higher Education, said, "We work closely with our pupils to help them secure places at some of the best universities in the world. And it is wonderful to see so many of our leavers thriving at institutions of the highest caliber. These destinations reflect not only academic excellence, but also the ambition and commitment shown by our pupils throughout their time at MCS. We are immensely proud of all they have achieved and look forward to following their future successes." Magdalen College School is one of the top performing schools in the country, ranking in the top 20 independent secondary schools in the Sunday Times Parent Power Schools Guide 2026. While there has been coeducational sixth form at the school for 15 years, the school announced earlier this year that it will become fully coeducational over the coming decade. The transition will be a gradual one. The school in Cowley Place will welcome girls into year 3 and year 4 in September 2027 and year 7 in September 2030, joining the existing cohort of sixth form girls. The school was founded in 1480 as a song school and department for Magdalen College, and continues to educate the 16 boy choristers of Magdalen Chapel Choir. Helen Pike announced earlier this year that she has decided to step down as master at the end of the 2026-27 academic year, and the recruitment process for her replacement is now underway. The first female master at MCS, Ms. Pike guided the Board of Governors to one of the most significant decisions in the school's history, to become fully coeducational. Former pupils at the school include Cardinal Thomas Wolsey, St. Thomas More, Sir Tom Hunt, a Nobel Prize winner, and director Sam Mendes and top actor Jonathan Bailey.
Notice to listeners of Oxhawk who may wish to use an Alexa smart speaker to access our service. To listen to Oxhawk on an Alexa device, you can use the talking newspaper skill. You will need to first enable the skill. To do this, simply say, "Alexa, enable talking newspaper." Then, to listen to Oxtalk, please follow this procedure.
Alexa, open talking newspaper.
Welcome to your talking newspaper skill. Please say the name of a newspaper or a town or city you would like to hear from.
Oxford.
Here are the following newspapers nearest to Oxford. Please pick a newspaper name. Oxford and District Talking News, Whitney Talking News Latest Edition, Whitney Talking News Previous Edition, Whitney Talking Magazine, Wallingford, and District Talking Newspaper. Or do you want to hear more?
Oxford and District Talking News.
Do you want to listen to Oxford and District Talking News?
Yes.
This is Oxford and District Talking News.
If you have any problems listening to OxTalk using an Alexa device, it could be due to the way that your device is set up. Please check the settings with whoever set it up in the first place. If you still have problems, please contact OxTalk and we will try to help.
A Doctor Who actress and a former Prime Minister, among other stars, received Oxford University degrees. 9 distinguished figures from political, arts and academic sectors were bestowed the honorary degrees during a traditional senior ceremony on Wednesday. They included Dame Jacinda Ardern, former Prime Minister of New Zealand, leading economist Professor Darren Acemoglu, and former principal dancer at the Royal Ballet, Carlos Acosta. Actress and director Adjoa Ando, known for roles in Bridgerton and Doctor Who, was also awarded a degree. Also honoured were Harvard University's professor Henry Louis Gates, Jr., biochemist Professor Catalin Carrico, former number one world tennis player Billie Jean King, engineer Professor Shuji Nakamura, and Dame Emma Walmsley. Oxford University announced it would relax the strictly formal dress code for guests and those participating in formal processions. A statement from Oxford University said, "In light of the heat warning, the usual expectations regarding formal attire have been relaxed across all insignia events. Guests are welcome to dress in a way that is comfortable and appropriate for the conditions. Jackets, gowns, and other additional layers are not expected, except for those participating in formal processions, where wearing them remains optional. Additional measures have been put in place at all insignia event locations to help guests manage the heat." Cotswold Wildlife Park has produced the highest number of frozen treats and enrichments in the park's 56-year history to keep its more than 2,500 animals cool during what could be a record-breaking heat wave. Temperatures are expected to reach almost 40 degrees centigrade across Oxfordshire, as the Met Office warns of danger to life during the red heat alert. As temperatures climbed during the year's second heat wave, keepers were hard at work creating ice enrichments to help the animals stay cool. The giraffes, including Century, the park's oldest giraffe, were treated to a frozen ice block made from carrot, cabbage and apple. The herd of Bactrian camels enjoyed a frozen cocktail of carrot, cabbage, watermelon and apple. The blocks took over 2 days for mammal keeper Charlotte to create, just for the camels to devour them in less than 2 hours. Even the park's newest arrival, Klaus, enjoyed the treat.
That was the last of our articles for this week. If you have any comments or feedback about OxTalk, we now have a new landline number for you to call. The number is 01865 377 635. That's 01865 377 635. Please leave a message for Michelle, our listener coordinator. Alternatively, you can call Margaret on 074-96-06-2280. That's 074-96-06-2280. Please remember to leave your name and a contact number with your message. Or you can send an email to mail@oxtalk.org.uk. This edition and those from the previous 4 weeks are available on our website, www.oxtalk.org.uk, where you can either listen directly or download the audio file. The current edition is also available on Alexa using the Talking Newspapers skill. Instructions on how to do this are contained in a separate track in this edition. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more news. So until then, we hope you have a good week.